Hello, this is Dan Kilbride. I'm the host of New Books in American Studies, and I'm also the chair of the History Department at John Carroll University outside of Cleveland, Ohio. And here at New Books in American Studies, we take books in any field regarding American literature, history, popular science, technology, you name it, but it tends to be history on this show. And we interview the author for about an hour. So today we are joined by Michael O'Brien, who's professor of American intellectual history at Jesus College and Cambridge University. And we're talking to him about his book, The Letters of C. Van Woodward, published by Yale University Press in 2013. This is a first for New Books in American Studies. We've only dealt with monographs in the past on this show, and this is the first time we're dealing with primary sources. But this is an interview I'm very excited to do. I met C. Van Woodward once. My dissertation advisor was one of his students, and I'm a big fan of his writing and his scholarship. So this is an interview I've really been looking forward to. So Michael O'Brien, welcome to New Books in American Studies.
Thank you.
Would you tell everybody about yourself, please?
Well, I'm a British scholar, born in long time ago, 1948, in Devon in the West Country. And educated at Cambridge in the late 60s. I did an MA at Vanderbilt in Nashville for a couple of years, came back here to Cambridge to do my PhD, and then spent 20 more years in America. Postdoc at the University of Michigan. I taught at the University of Arkansas in the early 80s. I taught at Miami of Ohio for a good number of years until I came back to Cambridge in 2002. So I've mostly written American intellectual history, and most of my career until fairly recently was concerned with Southern intellectual history, first in the 20th century, and then I wrote a lot about the intellectual culture of the South before the Civil War. In recent years, I've done a bit with the Adams family of Massachusetts and one thing and another.
Now, I was in the audience when you accepted an award for Conjectures of Order, and at that point, you said you were through with Southern history, but here you are again. Are you like Michael Corleone? You just keep getting dragged back into something you're trying to get out
of? Well, I do keep being dragged back. It's true. Although, actually, I only semi-regard this as a venture in Southern history. He was an American historian. I mean, he was chiefly a Southern historian, of course, but he did write about some things which were not to do with the South. And although he was a Southerner and grew up there, he spent most of his adult or his later years in New England. So he's very much an American figure. So I see a bit more of a venture in American intellectual history than with Southern implications than just a venture in Southern history.
All right. I think that's pretty thin, but I'm going to let it go. as I mentioned in my intro, I once, a couple times, met C. Van Woodward. I was very excited. I actually told my family and friends, I met C. Van Woodward. And their response was, who is C. Van Woodward? So, which was depressing. And I want to talk about that a little bit later. But could you, in your introduction to this book, you give a very tight, concise explanation for why Woodward is historically important. That is, can you just explain what was Southern history, especially the history of the late 19th century, which he specialized in, what was it like before he came onto the scene, and what did he do to change that perception, and what was his greatest accomplishment as an historian?
Well, before he came along, the history of the writing of the history of the American South was really firstly preoccupied with the colonial period. It usually spent a lot of time talking about Virginia and the American Revolution and Washington and Jefferson and so forth. And then it tended to skate rather rapidly over the antebellum period and get to the Civil War, and then they would say, oh dear, how unfortunate it all was, and how still more unfortunate was radical Reconstruction. And then for the period afterwards, they tended to write books which were very celebratory of the New South, and it was all going swimmingly. There was a few problems with difficult farmers and difficult black people and so on, but on the whole, it was going well, and we should all feel reasonably pleased with ourselves. And that the South, as it became more urban and more industrial and so forth would eventually match Massachusetts and New York and so on.
Though, as you point out, with better manners and more sensible racial relations.
Indeed,
right?
Yes. Now, Woodward thought almost all of this was nonsense. He wasn't terribly interested in the colonial period. And in fact, for most of his career, he was not that interested in the antebellum period, although he dabbled a bit. But he was terribly interested in the question of the New South and where it came from. And he was a racial liberal, and he was very unhappy about segregation and racial oppression, and also about rural poverty, tenant farmers, sharecroppers, and was a great fan of the populists and the populist challenge of the late 19th century. So he kind of turns Southern history on its head, really, by identifying the characteristics of the regime that emerges out of Reconstruction and the period of the late 19th century. And he does see the period from the 1870s through to the end of the 1890s as a sort of period of contestation and difficulty, where it all begins to bed down, in his view, not very happily. That a kind of deal is struck between elite white Southerners and northern industrialists, basically to squash poor white farmers and blacks, and that's the regime which persisted into his childhood. He was born in 1908 in Arkansas, and into his early manhood when he was living in Arkansas and then Georgia and then North Carolina and latterly Florida. So he challenged the status quo, and it was very clear in him. He was politically engaged as a scholar, and he wanted this regime to be gotten rid of and work to achieve that.
The interpretation that you just laid out was most famously articulated in his book, The Origins of the New South. Can you explain, as you mentioned, the editors of that series in which that book appeared were not did not share Woodward's view of Southern history?
No, they didn't.
Why did they pick him?
Well, it's not utterly clear. They had asked someone else to do it first. It should be said that this series of which indeed still exists and indeed is still not finished, but was set up by a fund out of the University of Texas in the 30s. And the volumes ran, there were a bunch of volumes that ran from the colonial period onwards. Some pretty good, some pretty bad. And this was, you know, the last volume, and I think in a way the one they were least interested in or engaged with, because it wasn't – I mean, they saw the heart and soul of the history of the South as the Revolution and the colonial period and then the Civil War, and the bit that followed was not such a big deal for them. But they'd asked a scholar at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, called Benjamin Kendrick, to do it. And he agreed to do it, but then he kind of backed out and changed his mind, as often happens with these series. And they were kind of casting around, and Kendrick and a few others suggested Woodward, because he just published his biography of Tom Watson, which had been a great success, critical success. And he, to be fair, although if you read the book with any sensitivity, you can see his political commitments, but he'd not been that public a radical, really, unless you were really paying attention. So they offered it to him, and he said yes, but I'm sure they had no idea what they were doing. I mean, it turned out fine for them in the sense that the book was a great success eventually.
Right.
But I'm sure many of them were not happy is what they eventually got. But it took a long time for them to get it. I mean, he signed up for the book in whatever, 1940, and they don't get it till 1951, 52.
Well, this is a book of letters. So just let me ask you a fundamental question. What makes a good letter? I mean, why is Woodward a letter writer whose letters deserve to be read?
Well, there are various components that can go into a good letter or a body of letters. Some are, say, you know, who you're writing to or who you are. Obviously, there are some people whose letters get published who are their letters are published even though they may not be great letter writers because they happen right. to be very important people, Charles Darwin or or whoever. There are some people who are not terribly important, but are brilliant at it. I mean, the most famous example is Madame de Sévigné, the great late 17th century French letter writer, who's a minor aristocrat, otherwise not terribly interesting. And then there are some people who are great both in their intellectual or whatever political competence who happen also to be wonderful letter writers. There aren't many of those. I mean, in the ancient world, Cicero is one. In the 18th century, Voltaire. And then there are people who are reasonably important. And if they write good letters, they get published. And then if they don't write good letters, they don't get published. And Woodward is sort of that case, really. So what makes a good letter? Well, it's sometimes it's who it's written to, you know. If you're writing a letter to someone important, Thomas Jefferson or, I don't know, F. Scott Fitzgerald or something, then people might care. It can be good for all kinds of reasons. I mean, it can be good gossip, which people like to read. It can be stylish. It can usually editions of letters are worthwhile because they tell you something about the person, either the person written to or the person writing, which you might not otherwise know, which fill out a biography or might, I mean, if it's a novelist, say, it might be a letter to a publisher, an editor or something, which would tell you something about the genesis of a book or whatever it may be. So there's all kinds of reasons why letters. I mean, there's no single template, I wouldn't have thought, for a letter.
One of the most surprising things I read in these letters was Woodward's recommendation to somebody that they destroy some personal correspondence.
Yes.
Were you surprised or maybe even horrified to read that?
I was surprised, actually. Because it was very – I went – obviously went through his – all his papers at Yale in the Sterling Library. He gave his papers to Yale. Indeed, he gave all his literary copyright to Yale. Although, there, of course, there are letters from him in other people's collections in other archives. But the bulk of them are there. Unfortunately, he kept carbons of almost all of his correspondence from the from the mid-30s onwards. So that makes one's task a lot simpler. But it was very clear, if you go through the papers, indeed, if you even look through the inventory of it, that there are very few what one might regard as personal letters. There are three letters to his wife, although I'm sure there were hundreds because he was often out of town and traveling and so on. There are a few letters to his son. There are a handful of letters to his there's one letter to his father. There's nothing from his parents or much in the way of relatives. He had a sister who lived very far away, and I would imagine they might have corresponded, although I don't know that. And there's none of that. And it's very clear that he destroyed it. He was a very private, reserved man, and he just, as he says in this letter that you mentioned, he just thinks, you know, there's nobody's damn business, his private life. And the letter is to a woman who writes to him who describes herself as a friend of George Pearson, who was a historian at Yale, in fact, the chairman of the department when Woodward was hired there. And she writes to Woodward and says, well, because Woodward was a good friend of Pearson, writes to him and says, well, I've got these private letters. What do I do with them? What do I do with them? And he says, burn them. Or if you can't bring yourself to burn them, tell your lawyer to burn them when you die. And then launches into this little explanation of why he basically thinks that it's none of the world's business. I think he thought, you know, that there are too many people interested in prurient details and,
sure.
and so on.
Sure.
And now, whether he had anything in particular to hide, I have no idea. But probably not, although possibly, but who knows. But he just he thought the world had a right to be interested in him as a scholar and a historian and a teacher and so on, and all of that is meticulously preserved. But the other stuff is not our business, and so we don't know about it unless, of course, you could find out more by oral history and so on.
Sure.
But mm-hmm. that's his biographer's problem, not mine.
Yeah, and which that's what surprised me, because I would think that as a historian, Woodward would have a consciousness that those issues might be of interest to a biographer.
Yes, and he was a little inconsistent. He did, for example, John Roper, who in fact wrote a biography of Woodward, with which Woodward rather diffidently cooperated. But Roper had earlier written a biography of Ulrich Phillips, the historian of slavery, southern historian of slavery, who's in a generation or so before Woodward. And Woodward writes to him and says, "I'm glad to see that you talk about Phillips's private life, and that you know that you recognize that historians have private lives too." So it was not that he didn't think it was legitimate; he just didn't want anyone to do it to him.
But there are. These letters do offer very strong glimpses into Woodward's personality.
Yes.
They're very professional. I don't know if it's fair to say most of these letters, but very many of them regard his career as an historian, his career as an official in various historical organizations, as somebody who's reading manuscripts either privately or because the press asked them to.
Yeah.
What are the clearest aspects of his personality that you think emerge from these letters?
Well, I think the letters have two phases. The ones written when he's much younger are different. The ones we have, the earliest letter is from their late 20s, but they pick up in a serious way in about 1930. And the early letters are written to basically friends, especially a man called Glenn Rainey, who was his friend and contemporary at Emory University in the late 20s. And they wrote to each other all the time, hang out with one another. Rainey was a poet and Asmert historian and ended up in the English faculty at Georgia Tech eventually. There are some letters to a lover, a divorced woman that Woodward had an affair with in the mid-30s. And then there are letters to sundry other people, friends. And these are very much the letters of a young man making his way in the world, talking about his affairs, his feelings, his reading. He reads Proust. He goes to the Soviet Union to make a visit. He talks about that. He goes to graduate school. He talks about his experiences. So these are much more sort of candid, open, a little mannered, but mostly self-conscious. And then there's a bit of a silence during the war when he's in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And then they pick up again when he gets a job at Johns Hopkins in 1946. And at that point, he's and I should say that when he's younger, he's not at all committed to becoming a historian.
No, that's right. Yeah.
He's interested in lots of other possibilities, journalism, political activism. He really doesn't know what he wants to do, and he kind of falls into being a historian and then settles for it as the most plausible way to live, and then sort of commits himself to it in a pretty wholehearted kind of way. So the later letters are much more, as you say, professional. All the aspects of being a professional historian, the writing, the publishing, the teaching, the grant getting, the professional organizations, historical groups, and this and that. And the correspondence is much less or rather the friends with whom he is corresponding are friends because they are also historians or other intellectuals. He's friendly with David Riesman, the great sociologist, sundry other people. So these letters show you know how this world works, and so they're letters about people who write manuscripts and ask them to comment on them, or people who are responding to his publishing some review he may have published or some book he may have published or whatever. And they're personal in the sense that they're engaged with the person he's corresponding with, and he cares about what they're doing, and he's commenting on it, or he's responding to what they think about him. And sometimes there are more personal things about things going on in his life or so on. There are a few more personal things. I mean, his son dies of cancer when he's very young, mm-hmm. and there are a few letters in which he says something about that. But generally speaking, they're not intimate. But I mean, his pattern of friendships, unlike when he's very young, is, as it were, all tied up with his professional life. The people he's dealing with are his friends. Richard Hofstadter, to whom he was very close, mm-hmm. the great mm-hmm. historian at Columbia. They were engaged with each other professionally in the sense that they both were editors. They were editing together the Oxford History of the United States, a multi-volume history before Hofstadter died of leukemia in the late 60s. But they used to rent places on Cape Cod and hang out and go out to dinner and so on.
But they were so different as historians. I mean, as you mentioned, Woodward was kind of a conference junkie. He was traveling all the time. He was involved in historical organizations of all sorts, where Hofstadter had very little time for that. He had no interest in the kind of bureaucratic aspects of the profession at all.
No, he didn't. He just sort of stayed at home in Manhattan and wrote his books. And I mean, he would occasionally venture out, but not very often. And he had grave misgivings. I mean, Hofstadter basically saw himself as reaching a popular audience. Mm-hmm. Whereas Woodward, although he was very interested in the popular audience and not infrequently did reach it, although not so much Origins of the New South, but the Tom Watson book sold pretty well. But the book of his that sold enormously, millions of copies, was a book called The Strange Career of Jim Crow, which was a series of lectures he gave at the University of Virginia in the mid-50s, which is a interpretation and a narrative about the emergence of the segregation system. And, of course, it was significant because this is precisely the moment that segregation is unraveling. So people are trying to understand what it is that they're dealing with, and Woodward is the person who gives them the most, then thought to be the most cogent. And it was a book that was successful not just because every other professor adopted it for courses, but because it reached a popular audience, both black and white.
You observed that Woodward's career took some interesting twists and turns. As you said, he only entered the historical profession very hesitantly and ambivalently. Mm-hmm. And then his career just took off with the Origins of the New South. But at a certain point, he really stopped writing original research. Even though he signed on to write, he had contracts for any number of books that just never went anywhere. Why do you think that he just really stopped doing primary research and really focused on reviewing manuscripts, reviewing books?
There are several ways of explaining that. The interpretation I offer is that actually he was never that interested in original research. he gets into history because he's interested in the political system in the South in the 1930s, mostly because he doesn't like it. And he has a little idea for a book about Southern demagogues. And one of these Southern demagogues is Tom Watson, the Southern populist leader. So he decides, oh, well, no, maybe I'll just write about Tom Watson. And he happens to strike up a good relationship with various members of – Watson is dead at this point – members of Woodward and Watson's family, especially his granddaughter, who gave him access to this rich body of Watson papers. So he writes this biography, and along the way he – because he's – at this point, he's actually when he starts to get – he's unemployed. I mean, it's the Depression Yeah. And he has a few odds and ends of jobs with some New Deal agencies, but he wants to write this book, and it's put. And he has various friends at Chapel Hill who basically arrange for him to have a fellowship. So he does a PhD because it helps him pay his way while he's not terribly interested in having a PhD, but he just sort of gets it because it's convenient for him. And so he writes this book on Tom Watson. Now, for that, you know, he did a lot of research, but it was pretty convenient. I mean, it was basically all on his doorstep in Chapel Hill. And then he is not sure what to do next. He has a plan to write a biography of Eugene Debs, the great socialist leader. And he goes to Indiana to talk to Debs' family about, but they don't want to know because he's a Southerner and they think he's deeply suspicious. So that doesn't work out. And then he gets offered this volume in the history of the South, and he takes it because he knows this is a great opportunity to write it, because no one had written a serious book about that period. So I mean, it was a great opportunity. And he has to do kind of manuscript research because there hasn't been a body of monographs to synthesize at this point. So he sort of has to do the spade work himself. And he does that pretty conscientiously before he gets in the Navy, and then in the late 40s when he gets out again. But he never liked it. and, you know, you can understand. Some people do, some people don't. Like it enormously, but some people find it a bit of a grind going off and sitting in hotels and going off to the archive and so on, and eating bad food in cheap diners. But
you make it sound so romantic. Yes. And yes.
But then he finishes his book, and it's a great success. It wins the Bancroft Prize and so on. And then he writes The Career of Jim Crow, which is not a research-based book at all. In fact, it's, right, as right. some people have pointed out, it's based on, in fact, scandalously few sources. And he wrote it terribly fast. I mean, he had been asked to give these lectures at the University of Virginia. And, I mean, sort of 3 months before, he basically has no idea what he's going to talk about. So he does it on the hoof, really. Does it brilliantly, but it's pretty much on the hoof. Now, because he's successful and noticed, as people of this kind are, they get asked to do stuff by publishers, by especially newspapers. He starts reviewing for the New York Times and various, and then in the 60s becomes a great regular contributor to the New York Review of Books, which becomes the preeminent journal of opinion, I think, for many years. I'm not sure it still is, but certainly for a long time it was. So there's lots of demands placed on him. Plus, he goes to Yale. He has lots of students, and that's a sort of more of a bully pulpit as well. So the fact that he never really fancied original research in the first place, but that he had always been terribly interested in as it were, being a public intellectual, to use a not very satisfactory phrase. I mean, he had published things in newspapers when he was still a student in Atlanta, and he was always interested in doing things for the New York Republic and so on in the 30s. So when suddenly all of this is available to him, that's what he does, because that's what he enjoys and what he feels he's good at. And the degree of his commitment to the sort of grind of historical research and the sustained monograph or whatever, he just let that slide, really. And I think he thought, I mean, he actually never talks about it, at least that, nothing that I've ever seen in his papers or in letters or anything. And I knew him in his later years, and he certainly never talked about it to me. So there's no I mean, the main thing that he failed to do is he signed out to write a book on Reconstruction in the 60s. And at least to the late 60s, he was still sort of poking around with it, but it just quietly fades away, and he never mentions it again.
I don't know how he would have done it, given all his other commitments.
Well, you do it by giving up some of those other commitments, and that was what he was not willing to do, really.
Yeah, he seemed to enjoy many of those things. One of the things that you describe in the book, and many of the letters deal with this, is as his role of as what you call as a literary midwife, as somebody who not only reviewed many, many books, but reviewed many manuscripts. Not only those he was asked to review by a publisher, but just people coming to him and saying, you know, would you read this for me? And I think you mentioned this or give your opinion about this. He's sort of a model of as somebody who saw himself as not so much a critic, but as somebody who was responsible for giving constructive criticism. And some of his criticism is pretty sharp and severe. One of the letters is to, I think, John Hope Franklin, who was writing a report, maybe it was, on civil rights.
Yes.
And Franklin really wrote exclusively about African Americans. Right. And Woodward said, look, if you're going to do this, you either got to change the title or you got to go back to the drawing board. Can you just talk about Woodward's role as you say, a literary midwife?
Well, it begins, I think, pretty much in the 50s when he's at Hopkins. And you must remember that he starts life this is not a satisfactory word, but I'll use it anyway – as a sort of provincial. I mean, he's from Arkansas. He grows up in Georgia, most Arkansas in Georgia, goes to local Southern universities, Emory, which wasn't much of a place really in the 20s, to be frank. University of North Carolina, which is better. I mean, it's certainly arguably the best Southern university in the 20s and 30s. But was not without its provincialisms, and although he did spend a year in New York in the early 30s, he did an MA at Columbia briefly, but he didn't stay. I mean, he liked New York, but he didn't much take to Columbia. But he travels. He goes to Europe several times. He goes to the Soviet Union, for example, and he's interested in wider horizons. But he's not worldly wise or metropolitan man. But when he goes to Hopkins, which actually suits him quite well for a long time because it's semi-southern in Baltimore, but it's also very connected to the Northeast. And his horizons begin to expand, his connections with newspapers, periodicals, but especially with other historians at places like Princeton and Columbia. And he never has many connections with Harvard, but Yale. He gets more involved with national historical organizations. He'd been involved with the Southern Historical Association from quite early on and was its president in the early 1950s. He's moving in a much bigger pond, really. So he begins to attract more attention, and people begin to see that he's a very good critic. But also, and as you say, could be very severe, but it's always very constructive. I mean, he had a gift for seeing where a manuscript was strong, where it was weak, but especially what you could do with it in order to fix it. And he had a range. I mean, he was sensitive to literary style as well as questions of evidence and theoretical considerations. I mean, not that he was that interested in what later is called theory. I mean, he was somewhat impatient with formal philosophy, but in the sense of interrogating people's political or cultural values or their literary values. He was extraordinarily gifted at that, and sort of the word got around. So sometimes it's historians, quite senior people like Richard Hofstadter, who will send him things to read. Sometimes it's Southerners who see him as a sympathetic critic. So James Silver, who publishes this very controversial book called Mississippi, the Closed Society, sends him the manuscript, Woodward the manuscript, to read. Sometimes it's students of other people, several of Hofstadter's students get in contact with Woodward and he reads their stuff. And it sort of flowed. And he did, I mean, and he quite liked sort of spotting talent and helping people along. I mean, he was very, when I was a young scholar, he kind of semi-adopted me for a bit and read some things of mine. And I, you know, I was one of many people he did this to. So, but I mean, it ate up a lot of time for him. But I think he basically, I mean, he enjoyed it. He thought it was one of the services he could render.
And a lot of people came to him. One of my favorite letters is one of the shortest, and that is, it's a student at McAllister College in Minnesota, an undergraduate, who writes to him and basically says, you know, what makes you tick? What is your philosophy of history? Yeah. And Woodward writes her back and basically says, yeah, that's a good question.
Right.
I don't know if I have
right.
one. And it's a charming letter. And I think a lot of historians, and not just historians, would have ignored it, maybe.
Well, he was pretty good. I mean, although most of his correspondence is, as it were, professional, because he had a public profile and because he published in the New York Times or the New York Review of Books and so on, which had much wider readerships, and because some of his books had a wider readership, he did get letters quite often from, as it were, the lay reader, his sort of public. And he always, I mean, as far as I can tell, he always replied. Now, sometimes he would reply somewhat, if it was a particularly silly letter, in a somewhat perfunctory way. But sometimes they've asked him something that would pique his interest, and he would reply more extensively. Some of these letters are like the one you mentioned, where he's actually, I think, being mischievous. And amusing himself. I mean, both in one sense, answering straightforwardly, but it's also a bit of a chore. So, I mean, he tries to make it more interesting for himself by
right.
saying
mm-hmm.
something a little cleverer. Later in his life, he often gets letters in which he does a little bit of autobiographical, because people often write to him and say, oh, tell me a bit about yourself, or students are doing papers on him in their courses
yes.
and write to him and sort of say, basically, you know, can you write my paper for me? and he usually declines, but sometimes they might ask a more intelligent question and he will reply. And that's actually quite valuable because he disliked autobiography. I mean, he always refused to write one. He semi-wrote one once. He gave the Fleming lectures at LSU in the early 80s, and they're called Thinking Back. And there is a little bit of autobiography in there, but it's mostly an account of the interpretations in his books and the responses of critics and his dialogue with critics. And he says almost nothing about his childhood. I mean, a little bit. And then he says a little bit about his time at Chapel Hill, but I mean, he fights shy. And he says in a letter somewhere that he just has no taste for autobiography. And this is to do with his kind of being very reserved and private. But he would sometimes get these letters and he would, you know, he'd throw in a paragraph, would say, someone might write to him and say, you won't remember me, but I was at high school in Arkansas or whatever. And he would then do a little autobiographical thing. And if you piece those together, you can flesh out his autobiography, the more intimate side of it, a little more. But they're pretty they're not that frequent for any.
You mentioned that Woodward visited the Soviet Union, and I think he actually briefly considered staying there in the early 30s.
Did, yes.
How did he avoid, in the 1950s, being tarred as a fellow traveler, as a maybe a troublemaker?
Well, he'd always been rather discreet about that. In fact, even at the time, when he's writing to his friend Glenn Rennie about his trip to Soviet Union, and he tells him some stuff, but then he says, "Don't tell anyone." So he's not, and although he's engaged in various left-wing causes, he helps in some strikes in North Carolina, and he's briefly interested in the Southern Tenant Farmers Union in Arkansas, one thing and another. He's particularly involved, there's a thing called the Angelo Herndon case in Atlanta, where a black activist is charged for inciting rebellion under an old Reconstruction statute, and there's a public protest in Woodward's involved in that. So he'd been active, but I mean, not that publicly active. I mean, he was, as far as I know, he was never in the Communist Party. I mean, he was certainly friendly with some communists, mm-hmm. and there were letters from various Communist Party members to him. So he was sympathetic, but I don't think it ever went beyond that. It wouldn't astonish me if it did, but it would astonish me a wee bit if it did. Well, why does he invite him? Well, he served in the military, which usually helps. Not if you're Joe McCarthy, it doesn't help, but since Eisenhower was a traitor too, but that helped a bit. I think he was just kept his head down, was a bit lucky, wasn't important enough really to be, at that point, to be targeted by anyone in particular. And there were bigger fish. I mean, notably at Hopkins, there were various more important figures who got attacked by McCarthy and others. Mm-hmm. But he's very interested in that, and I think he was conscious that he was on the margin. I mean, you know, something might have happened. He only suffered from this once, and he told me, in fact, about this, and there's a letter in the collection which speaks to this. He was Samuel Eliot Morrison, the great Harvard historian, who was also an admiral and was involved. The Joint Chiefs of Staff used to have a board of his sort of historical advisors, which Morrison orchestrated, and he suggested that Woodward be on this board. So Woodward's name goes forward, and they don't give it to him because they won't give him a security clearance. Mm. And it's very clear that they dug around a bit. And in particular, I think the thing which got him that killed this was that he was involved in a minor administrative capacity with the Southern Conference for Human Welfare, which was a more radical group in the late 1930s in the South. And so there's a letter to Woodward to the man, the colonel, who sort of has informed him of this failure to be cleared, which is a bit distressed, sort of saying, "Oh, well, I'm, you know, my patriotism is not to be impugned," and so on. But that, you know, by the standards of the 1950s, that's, you know,
yeah, it's pretty tame,
modest business.
It's, I suppose, it's and whatever. I don't know if you ever appreciated this, but it's sort of ironic that. You know, as he dabbled in, you know, communism and radical causes early in his life, as the historical profession radicalizes in the 1960s, Woodward came to be seen as almost the quintessential institution man. And the letters which span his very long career really trace his growing ambivalence with some trends in the profession.
Yes.
But, you know, for a long time in the 1960s, there's a spirit, I think, in his letters where he's sort of like the happy warrior.
Yes.
And there's one account in particular. I think it was the 1969 meeting of the American Historical Association.
Oh, yes.
Which is a riot.
Right.
Woodward may well have been alienated by that, but he clearly was not. He kind of relished this role as almost a mediator in between sort of the more radical factions.
That's true.
Led by Herbert Aptheker, and then it was Jean Genovese. Could you just tell us about how Woodward kind of negotiated that the politicalization of the profession in the late 1960s?
Well, the situation is that he's the president of the American Historical Association, and in the convention in the around Christmas 69-70. In New York, there's a radical caucus which basically wants the association to go on record against the Vietnam War. And this is led by Stoughton Lind and a number of other people. And so the business meeting, which traditionally the AHA, as in all such associations, is usually a sleepy little event with about five people who show up looking bored. Suddenly, hundreds and hundreds of people show up because they nominated an alternative to the sort of establishment nominee for the next president, which was going to be Lind. I mean, not Lind was the alternative radical proposal. So there's this tumultuous business meeting over which Woodward has to preside, and he basically carries the day. He, you know, the establishment candidate gets in. The proposal for the association to go on record against the Vietnam War gets killed off. And in some ways, this was as indeed there's a letter to Woodward later on, basically saying to him, well, you seem rather keen on politicizing the historical profession when you were a young man against segregation and one thing and another. And he helped to desegregate the Southern Historical Association in the 50s and late 40s. And he was the program committee chair who first asked the black scholar John Hope Franklin to give a paper at the Southern in Williamsburg in the late 40s. And someone writes to him and says, well, you know, how come what you did when you were young was fine, but what these other people wanted to do. And he didn't have a very satisfactory answer, frankly, because I think probably he was a bit inconsistent. But he did think, and, you know, it's a defensible position that historical organizations really shouldn't be in the business of micromanaging political positions and being against this war or for this war, against abortion or for abortion, or and that's, I mean, though it's the business of individual historians or citizens to do that if they want to, but it's really not their collective responsibility. So that was an honest enough position, but I think those wars were to his taste because they were about foreign policy, race, questions of social justice, which was the sort of heart and soul of his approach to the world and to history. Later in the 80s, really, when other kinds of issues come up, issues of sexual identity, issues of multiculturalism, issues of theory, post-structuralism, postmodernism, and so on. This is a completely different kind of discourse, and he's deeply uncomfortable with it and mostly opposed to it. He wasn't, although he, in principle, was all in favor of women doing better in the profession, he wasn't that interested in it and never really got the hang of feminism. He was very upset by multiculturalism.
Right, there are a number of letters to Arthur Schlesinger Jr.
And I think he was pretty – well, I don't know. I mean, there are lines where there are indications he was not – he was homophobic. I mean, I don't think a big deal, but, I mean, he wasn't very comfortable with gay rights and all that.
It wasn't unusual.
No. Well, he was – you know, he was of his era. He was
– Sure.
Mm-hmm. He was, after all, born in 1908, so – he lived a long time.
Yeah. One of the things he's also, you know, besides issues of, you know, multiculturalism especially, that he seems to have been discomforted by also trends in the scholarship, especially, as you mentioned, the rise of theory and different kinds of theoretical perspectives. But there's also an interesting letter to James McPherson, I believe it is, where I think McPherson, who was writing Battle Cry of Freedom, you know, one of the volumes in the Oxford History, where he, I think McPherson proposes a volume on social history, And Woodward basically says, how would you do that?
Yes.
You know, how would – you know, show me the table of contents, yes, for example.
Yes.
Was Woodward discomfited by just challenges to sort of the narrative of American and other sorts of histories that were posed by these?
He was committed to narrative. I don't think that – I mean, he just thought although when he – Macpherson first proposed this volume – that there should be. I mean, I should say that the Oxford History of the United States says it was originally designed by Hofstadter and Woodward in the late 50s, early 60s. Were mostly chronological chunks of time, a colonial volume and one on the American Revolution and whatever. But there are also some thematic ones intended. Originally, there was going to be a volume on the intellectual history of the United States, a volume on the economic history of the United States, a volume, as indeed there is eventually published, a volume on its foreign relations and so on. And, of course, all that is being designed before the rise of what was then came to be called the new social history. So Macpherson says to him, well, shouldn't we have a volume on social history too? And Woodward says, oh, well, yes, maybe that's a good idea. But then he goes off and talks to Edmund Morgan at Yale, and Morgan basically says, you can't do it. It's not – and the main objection, which I don't actually think is terribly cogent, but it seemed cogent to Morgan and Woodward, was that the raw materials of social history were so disparate. I mean, social history is after all, everything that happens, right? One way or another, and the patterns of it. And to do a single volume over the whole span of American history, which would do justice to everything that could possibly be called social history, is basically an impossible narrative task. And that was his main objection. Now, I think it's also true that some of the things that the new social history was interested in, he didn't think were terribly important. I mean, his main imagination as a historian focused on economics and politics, and he was also interested in intellectual history, not so much in a very formal way, but he was interested in literature and the sort of imagination of Americans. But much beyond that, he tended to lose interest. So he said no, and there never has been a volume on the social history of the United States in the series.
Did Woodward ever get a sense that he was in some ways becoming positioned as almost a conservative within the profession? That is, somebody who was
knew that
standing astride trends.
It made him rather uncomfortable, and in particular, his objection to multiculturalism put him in some of us might think some dodgy company. I mean, he accepted an award from the National, whatever they're called,
National Association of Scholars or something like that. And we reviewed sympathetically Dinesh D'Souza's
– that produced a firestorm of criticism of him. And he's a bit puzzled, I mean, by it all. I mean, because he kind of thinks he's where he always was, which was – although he was never that comfortable with the word liberal, and indeed that – some months he would deny it. I mean, he would describe himself as a populist or a quasi-Marxist or a radical. But there are other moments in his career where he was willing to call himself a liberal, and I think particularly later in life. In fact, not insignificantly, when liberalism is under attack, as increasingly irrelevant in the 80s and 90s, and he warms to it because he tended to like being in a minority dissident position. So he tended to move around the landscape a bit depending on as the context shifted. But he does have a puzzled letter to somebody, Cushing Strout, I think, in the 90s, where he basically says, well, you know, I don't seem to have moved, but all these other people seem to have moved. which, of course, if you're a historian, you ought to – it's not easy to figure out that that's what's going to happen. But.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we've taken up just about an hour of your time. Just before I let you go, though, what is next on the plate for you?
Well, two things. I'm editing with several other people a volume of essays on the present state of American intellectual history. We had a conference at Harvard and another at Cambridge, and that's turning into a book pretty imminently. My main task in the next several years, I've signed up to write a general intellectual history of the United States from the 17th century onwards, as a kind of work of synthesis, which no one has done for a generation and a half. So it's probably time someone did it, and I seem to be foolish enough to try.
Well, I take back the tease I threw your way in the beginning of the interview that you're doing Southern history again, because it's like,
although
okay,
Southerners will pop up now and again in the narratives. I don't know.
Okay. Like, good for them. Yes, they do. Well, Michael O'Brien, I want to thank you again for spending this time with us. Just a great subject. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Once again, this is Dan Kilbride at New Books in American Studies. We've been talking with Michael O'Brien about his new edition of The Letters of C. Van Woodward. And when you go on the interview page at New Books, you will see a little icon with this book, and it'll link you to Amazon. So throw some royalties Michael's way, and Yale could use the money. So buy this book. So we'll see you later on our next interview.